Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of May 29th, 2015. About a year ago, I had a flash of inspiration. I'd been feeling like people my age never quite had the right generational label. Not Generation X, and not Millennials either. My colleague Adrian Hill was working on a story about classroom technology, and we talked about playing this computer game with oxen, wagons, and intestinal distress in middle school. Oregon Trail. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. So here's what I wrote on Twitter. Too young for Generation X? Too old to be a millennial? Welcome, Oregon Trail generation. You died of dysentery. 1,100 retweets later, I was pretty convinced of my brilliance. It turns out other people had thought of the Oregon Trail generation before I did, but the huge response I got confirmed for me just how much people like talking about our generations and what they mean. So this week's show is all about generations and how who we are, from the greatest generation to Generation Z, shapes how we live with money. Oh, and we're doing the show like Benjamin Button, starting with retirees and working our way to high school students. So listen for yourself or your parents or your kids, and tell us what generation you are on MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We're beginning with the end on the show today. Retirement. And not in a fuzzy, far-off way, but how it feels and how to pay for it. We're talking about the psychology with Nancy Schlossberg. She's the author of Revitalizing Retirement, Reshaping Your Identity, Relationships, and Purpose, and The Money with Rhonda Schaffler. She's the editor-at-large at The Street and the anchor of The Street TV. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks.
I want to start backwards in time with people who are already retired, because it seems to me like retirement is about preparation and then calibration once you're already there. So, Rhonda, from the money end, when you talk to people about retirement, how much of it is calibrating the sweet spot of what you have to spend and at what pace?
Well, that is a big part of it, because, of course, you can only spend to go with what you've saved to get to the retirement point. So generally speaking, there's a rule of thumb that you should have about 70% of what your income was when you were working. So that means your costs, your expenses have to come down because you will have less money. And that, by the way, is assuming you have saved enough money.
Right.
So it's a very delicate balance. And as we know, we've seen study after study, most people aren't getting it right.
Nancy, when you talk about sort of psychological calibration, are people in retirement prepared for how they feel once they get there?
I don't believe so. First of all, I think especially for men and women who are highly invested in their work, who love what they're doing, the thought of retirement creates some anxiety. They aren't ready, they don't want it, and so they're not prepared for it. I was interviewing a man who was a CEO of a Fortune 100 company, and he has a pension of over $1 million. So you wouldn't say he's poor. And he said to me, retirement is hollow. I said, hollow? And he hit the table. He said, this is solid. Retirement is hollow. He had no idea that he would lose some of his power, some of his prestige, even though he was still a very rich man and had led a major company. He was in a state of shock. It never occurred to him that it would turn out that way. I mean, there are some people who really prepare, but for most people, or a lot of people, they're not prepared for that emptiness, that feeling of, I don't have a purpose anymore.
So I guess to have the psychological space to sort of have that conversation with yourself, you want to not feel like the wolf is at the door all the time, Rhonda, right?
Yes, it was so interesting listening to Nancy's story, because she heard a word we don't hear a lot, and that's pensions. This gentleman who's struggling is in many ways in better off because he has a pension. That is something that is rarer to find, which is why you will hear people say you must save. Obviously, the vehicle most people use now is a 401k, but people do not put as much money in there as they should. They also, of course, some of them who don't participate at all, in many ways are losing free money from their own company. But look, this is very difficult. People don't walk around with all sorts of extra cash in their pockets, especially now.
Yeah.
So it's a discipline. It's starting early. It's trying to take advantage of what's offered. And even then, you might still struggle.
Let's talk about the unexpected, because in the shadow of the recession, a lot of people couldn't retire when they wanted to, found themselves anxious, nervous, working longer. Are there practical things that each of you think you can do to sort of, I guess, prepare for what you can't prepare for?
You know, one thing that's interesting, and I'd love to hear Nancy weigh on this as well, there is this very small but growing movement to have kind of a semi-retirement where companies are looking at the idea where maybe you're not working 40 hours, you're working 30. And it's one of these things where everyone wins. The company has an experienced person that can train a younger person. Maybe that's a good way to ease your way out of the workforce and start preparing for your life when you will not be working even 30 hours.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the more people can work part-time, can negotiate something with their company so that they're still earning money, but they're have more free time and they're beginning to think about what life will be like when they don't work.
Is there something specific to the baby boom generation and how so many people, I think about women coming into the workforce or people who don't have pensions anymore, about how they're negotiating retirement that other generations aren't? I mean, I think of my father, who practiced law, was sort of despondent for a year, and now does pro bono free clinic work, and that sort of gave him purpose back.
People can start new careers, probably socially useful, where they're not making money, but where they're doing something important to society, but also it's life-saving for them.
And there's also, of course, a move toward consulting work. That's another thing people do. They're still experts in their field. They become consultants. So they're earning some income. They have a purpose, if you will. And their expertise is being shared by companies who might actually need it.
So let's say you're listening to this right now and you want to kind of figure out what your options are. How do you do that?
Well, you do need, I think, to think about your finances very early. The minute you are working is when you should be thinking about it. Now, we know people don't want to think about planning ahead that way, but one number I'll throw out here that basically if you, for the next 30 years, if you're a young person, can save 15% a year, you should be okay in retirement. That's a lot to ask, 15%. It really is, especially for people starting out. You can start out in smaller amounts, try to build that up. So that's one way to get started is don't avoid it. Think about it early on. Don't give yourself the added stress of having to worry about finances. At thestreet.com, we have lots of different articles. You'll find information out there. Talk to people, but don't put it off because you're afraid and don't know where to start.
And this is a chance to think about regrets, things you have not done, of dreams that you've had, and start to think, well, when I retire, I can do X, Y, or Z.
Nancy Schlossberg and Rhonda Schaffler, thank you both very much.
It was fun.
It was great.
The people you're going to hear from next sound like they lived Nancy Schlossberg's advice. In fact, there's a growing group of Americans who don't want a retirement of golf and grandchildren. They're joining the Peace Corps. Right now, about 7% of Peace Corps volunteers are over 50, and Peace Corps wants to see that double. They're partnering with AARP to draw volunteers who have something that most people right out of college don't. Experience. Rosemary and John Botcher thought about maybe volunteering in the 1970s when they were in their 20s, but they never got around to it. But after visiting their daughter, who was a volunteer in Guatemala, they decided they could do it too, in Paraguay in 2011, when they were both in their late 60s. Rosemary is a retired chemist, and John is a retired environmental attorney.
Okay, well, this is my wife, Rosemary.
This is my husband, John.
I retired in 2005. Rosemary retired a little bit earlier.
And we've been married 47 years.
That's correct. Yes. And I served in the Peace Corps in Paraguay in 2011 to 2013. I am now 71 years old.
And I'm 72 years old.
And she served with me in the Peace Corps.
It was just a grand adventure. I just wanted to do something different because, just lying about when you're retired can get pretty boring pretty fast.
We retired several years ago, but we went in the Peace Corps after retirement.
And it's also good for your brain to have new adventures, especially learning a new language, which is difficult at our age.
It's not easy to go down there, particularly the language. It's difficult to learn a new language at any age.
Baby boomers, people who are retiring now, they have a lot to offer to other people in the world because we have so much experience in actually doing what our degree trained us to do. Paraguay, like many countries that Peace Corps serves, has a different attitude toward older people. Older people are revered, really. They're considered to be a fountain of wisdom, and Paraguayans are very kind to older people and pay attention to them and believe that they have valuable information to share. So that's in the States, that's not so true.
One thing I was impressed with immediately was how happy the locals were with nothing. That they were quite content and very busy and had very good lives.
Life was simpler, and I liked a simpler life, and I got used to it, except for no air conditioning. That was hard to get used to. But
you don't need fancy computers. You don't need expensive televisions. You don't need a big flat-screen television. You can get by with a small television.
It really doesn't take many things to be happy.
I think the biggest reward I had was toward the end of my service, watching Granny out there teaching other people how to do good agricultural techniques.
There's great joy in helping other people have a better life. There's nothing that brings me more pleasure than that.
We're focused on generations in today's show, but before we get back to that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures, serves them up at marketplace.org. So here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe, two of our millennials, with this week's numbers. All right, Tobin, what do you guys have today?
Today, we've got FIFA, food lobbies, and unicorns. Ready, Tony?
Let's do it.
14 soccer officials.
That's how many have been indicted by the DOJ for corruption related to international soccer.
Seven of them were with FIFA, and they were arrested early Wednesday in Zurich as the organization prepared for its annual meeting.
29.
That's how many billion-dollar startups,
also known as unicorns,
have sprung up this year.
That puts 2015 on track to have double the unicorns from last year.
1,114.
That's how many of Washington's 14,000 or so lobbying groups represent food suppliers.
And 35 of those groups are just for dairy.
So I guess you could say they handle a lot of moolah.
You proud of yourself?
That's the Smashing Pumpkins, and Gen Xers will probably recognize that song. And it's your turn now, because in this part of the show, we're talking about people and some technology that's confronting middle age, when you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech, in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
We're talking about generations on this show, and we're going to talk about instant messaging because the rubric we're using, it is a middle-aged technology that is aging well.
Yeah. It's aging well. Yeah.
It's Gen X, I guess.
Sure. I think it's been around for a while. right? It depends on how you define it, whether it's function we're talking about, network or user base. In terms of function, instant messaging has been happening since the days of the proto-internet. So 50 years ago, researchers at MIT were trading messages on a single network called the Compatible Time Sharing System, or CTSS. But this is 30 people tops communicating in one basic geographical place, right? Much later, in the 1990s, the user base of the internet exploded in a big way, and so people started using email and instant messaging much more. A lot of people who were using the internet in some form back then were using AOL Instant Messenger, which I'm sure you remember, Lizzie.
Yeah, we had a little buddy list, and it'd be like,
yes,
when the
yes.
door opened.
They each had their own sounds, right? There would be like a, right? And that launched in 1997.
What was your screen name?
My screen name was Brock22.
Mm.
Yeah, real deep. What was yours?
Lizzie O. I was an early adopter. I got Lizzie O. Although
Lizzie O.
I think
all
the
right.
best era time-stamped screen name goes to my little brother Jake, who we're now going to embarrass, whose screen name was Snoop Jakey J.
Snoop Jakey J. That's not a bad rap name. IM was huge in college, right? I don't know if this was true for you. For me, the school...
It wasn't there yet when I was in college.
It wasn't there yet. Okay,
really.
So for me, the school had a phone system, right? But people kind of stopped using it and started using AOL Instant Messenger, or IM as we called it, right? It was great for meeting up with people or making plans. It also admittedly had this kind of like big brother aspect too, right? Because you heard the door opening and closing when people would like sign on and sign off. You know, you could sort
of tell. Your crush Ben is in the room, but ignoring you right now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Does not want to hang out. There was this aspect of it that made it sort of better in some ways than using phones.
Why was AIM so popular? I mean, I think about the generation of people who took it to mass popularity.
Mm-hmm.
Gen Xers, people a little younger. What does it tell us about why it boomed?
Well, I think something to remember, Lizzie, is that the internet itself is all about communication. That's what it was basically built for in many ways. And instant messaging is the same thing. It's communication.
Disaffected Gen Xers reaching out for some sort of human lifeline.
Exactly. Maybe. But it was also being used on Wall Street. It was being used in schools, at home.
Wall Street was a really early adopter here. And traders still use the Bloomberg instant messaging system like gangbusters.
Sure, sure. It's something that's survived for a really long time. And this is why Apple released iChat, MSN Messenger came around. Some of these services actually worked and played nicely with others. Some of them did not. As instant messaging was starting to get going, it was sort of the beginning of tech companies fighting for online user bases.
So I think the question I have now about a middle-aged technology and users in multiple generations is how does this need for instant messaging, which everybody seems to really like, how do different platforms find their users where they are? And what's going to happen next?
Well, I think in terms of finding users where they are, you're starting by having this user base that has existed because of email in a lot of cases. And as instant messaging becomes more popular and more used, that's where you meet them. You meet them in a sort of place that already exists and that they're already opted into. You know, GChat launched in 2005. That's another great example of something a lot of Gmail users existed. And then when GChat launched, that sort of blew up. Now you've got a ton of other kinds of messaging services, right? You've got WhatsApp, 700 million users. You've got Skype, Viber. Even Snapchat's texting platform has instant messaging qualities where you can sort of see the other person responding to you while you're waiting. And you, I think, saw in Brazil, instant messaging really has gone global at this point. In terms of what's next, you know, one interesting thing that's already happening and we'll probably see more of is that instant messaging is happening at work. So a lot of businesses and companies do the vast majority of their customer service now with instant messaging.
I can IM my dentist's office, in fact.
See, there you go. And interestingly, I was at a company, which I can't mention the name of, but I was at a company the other day who told me that all of their customer service agents use instant messaging and use chat as a function because they can reply to multiple people at once. And you can't obviously do that on a phone. So this is this interesting thing that's happening. And, you know, as it's hit middle age, instant messaging is still really going strong because it's attached to this thing that we all love, which is communication.
Constant communication.
Yeah.
We here at Marketplace use Slack. A lot of offices, too.
That just barely launched, and it's worth almost $3 billion, according to the valuation at this point. So it's still a big deal.
So the big money-making question is, why do we need everything right away? Why do we always want it now? And is that true across generations?
I would say that we like instant gratification. I think that we're, to a certain degree, wired for that. And instant messaging is something that really gives us that in the technology that we all use. And that's probably part of why it's so successful and such a huge part of our technological lives.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
If you're somewhere in the middle generation-wise, like maybe a Gen Xer, you might be trying to figure out where you fit economically, between parents, siblings, or children maybe. And since the recession, a lot of Americans are combining multiple generations under one roof. That's the case for Amy Goyer. At work, she's the multi-generational expert at the AARP. And in her personal life, she's living that experience.
I moved across country from Washington, D.C. to Phoenix to take care of my parents. My mom was getting more frail. My dad had developed Alzheimer's disease. And at first, they lived in a senior community, and I moved into their home so I could be nearby. But within a couple years, they needed 24-hour care. So they moved back in the home with me. And then we have live-in caregivers that are there, often younger generation living with us. And my sister from Ohio comes to be there when I'm out of town and sometimes, you know, overlapping. And her kids may even be joining us. So we have quite an intergenerational and multi-generational household.
We're talking about generations as a theme on our show today. What do you think are the issues that emerge when you have so many generations under one roof? How does the money work?
So for the money, you know, one of the things that I recommend is that people talk about this before they move in together. Often they don't, and then you're in the situation, and who's paying for what? So you have to figure out how you're going to split up the expenses. Oftentimes, people will just cut everything down the middle and everybody pays part. But sometimes you may have, you know, the older generation, they're paying the mortgage and the younger kids are paying for the utilities, et cetera. In my situation, I cover the mortgage, the utilities. My dad's budget kicks in and helps with the food. So, you know, you really have to work that out and be clear about it because a lot of conflicts can arise over money.
There's been a post-recession boom in multi-generational housing, and some of this felt like it was forced by economic circumstance. But then as we've moved farther out, people are choosing to do this. When you talk to people, what are the reasons they give you?
You know, they often say they started this out for financial reasons or because of a housing crisis during the recession, but they continue it because of the benefits. They do see the cost savings, and that's always a bottom line benefit, but they also see the benefits relationship-wise, that they are having an opportunity to have those mutually beneficial intergenerational relationships. They're seeing the caregiving aspects of it can be beneficial, whether it's a younger generation caring for aging parents or perhaps the older generation helping to care for grandchildren. They see these benefits and they tend to say, you know, we could probably change the situation now. We're doing better financially, but we're going to choose not to.
You work for AARP, but I would imagine that a lot of the people you encounter are sort of Generation X or in their 40s, kind of balancing both parents and children.
Yes, we see the Generation X, but it also baby boomers even, and they may be what you call the sandwich generation or even the club sandwich generation where they've got their parents, their kids, and their grandkids that they're dealing with. And, you know, that can be a lot of pressure to be a little bit stuck in the middle. So I think it's really important if you're in that situation to get some time alone and take care of yourself as well.
I think about, you know, what it would be like to be with my own mother as an adult, and I know that, you know, having someone appear at my elbow and telling me I'm making the chicken wrong might drive me absolutely insane.
It's so funny. I hear anecdotally from people the most conflicts around the kitchen. And it's kitchen privileges, it's times of meals, what are we going to eat, how we're going to eat it, who gets to use these things. And, you know, I think people are unaware. One woman told me they had the biggest challenge over peanut butter and jelly sandwiches because her mother kept telling her how to make her kids' lunches for school. And, you know, after a big blow up, they realized that these are the things that go unsaid, and you need to be clear about it, be open with your communication when you're feeling a little bit stifled on something like that. You got to work these boundaries and these territories out.
So what are the practical tips if you're thinking that this might be something that's going to work for you?
First of all, I really recommend that families sit down and talk about these things before they move in together, but often you're already in the situation. Regardless, having regular family meetings, open communication about what's working and what's not working. Don't just focus on the problems. Talk about the things that are great.
As you think about this moving into the future, we've seen some of the big home builders in the country change the products that they offer. You know, not just nuclear family homes, but they're actually investing in and designing multi-generational housing. Is this a trend that you think is going to continue out into the future?
I do think that housing developers are going to more and more look at flexible housing options. We've got many cultures coming in this country that are growing, that it's very common to live multi-generationally. And I think people are liking these options where they have, you know, built-in, you might call them granny flats. There's a lot of options that way.
Amy Goyer is AARP's multi-generational expert. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
The average member of Generation X is now in their 40s. For a lot of people, that means thinking about money in a different way. Not just about making it, saving it, spending it, but also teaching it to their children. Our producer, Eliza Mills, visited Ivanhoe Elementary School in Los Angeles to talk to parents about what and how they teach their kids to think about money.
My daughter is 7 years old.
11 and 8.
7, 5, and 4.
I have a 1-boy 6-year-old.
I have a 6.5-year-old. She's going to finish up in first grade. A 4.5-year-old and a 3-month-old.
9, 7, and 5.
She's 7.5. She'll be 8 in June.
I teach my daughter about money by showing her when we're out shopping how much money something costs and to try to equate that to how long it takes me to earn something that she's buying.
How do we teach her about money? Right now, this sounds horrible. We're paying her for services. We're paying her for babysitting and things that she'll do to help us with her little sister. She has a sister who's 3.5. I don't know. I think that teaches her about the value of money.
Let them do chores around the house, help me in the yard, and give them not really a weekly allowance, but just depending on how much they do every week, they get some money.
But right now, if he does well in a week, it's kind of like an allowance. He will get probably $5 to $10. And the reason he learned is because of the tooth fairy. When his tooth fell, he got $5, and then so on and so forth.
They have piggy banks. I haven't done allowance yet.
Right now, a dollar doesn't mean very much to her. Like, it doesn't mean any different than a $20 bill. So basically, I'm mulling over the idea of giving her allowance and, like, taking her out to buy a present with her own money instead of me paying for a present. But I don't know. We'll see.
We each have a bank account that we make deposits or withdrawals from as necessary. But, yeah, that's about it so far. They don't do chores.
We pay her. It's a sliding scale based on the difficulty of the task. Like helping her sister with her bath is a dollar. Cleaning up the entire playroom and picking up all the toys in the house is maybe $3.
Hopefully you would put it in a savings account or save it for something special. But 9 out of 10 times it goes for them, especially for Lego sets.
Legos.
Junk. She was spending money on junk.
So far she's only saved her money. She has this piggy bank that's divided into categories, and she can save, donate, spend. I'm sure she thinks that she's going to spend it all. She says she's saving for a phone, which is not going to happen. So clearly there's a discussion that needs to happen there, or a computer. And so she has no idea. Like, she's got $45. She has no idea what she's going to be able to do with this money. So that's, I think, the next lesson is how much things cost.
I would hope that she would learn how to save it up for something that she really wants, and just to learn the value of money and how hard you have to work to earn it.
Nothing is given to you free, because in this day and age, and all the people who are in the entitlement group, I think they should know better.
I hope that she learns that money can make life easier. That sounds, I don't know if that sounds shallow or what, but I grew up without any money, and now I feel like I have the resources to have what I need, and I am aware every single day how much easier life is when you have the resources you need, and even a little extra. So I hope that, I don't know, how do you teach a child that's born with those resources? That's the big dilemma. That's the big question that my husband and I are facing. How do you teach them the value of money when they're born with what they need?
In the last part of our show, we're looking at the newest generations, millennials and Generation Z. If you watch any ad or read just about any publication, it's hard to escape the fascination with millennials. They're born somewhere between the mid-80s and the early 2000s, and it seems like every company is trying to figure them out, who they are, what they want. Mick McCabe is a chief strategy officer at the ad agency Leo Burnett. He says just about every meeting he's in is all about millennials.
What is a millennial? Well, millennial represents approximately 80 million of the U.S. population, which is a fourth. And they're roughly speaking somewhere between the ages of 18 to 34. It is the most diverse generation ever. Very tolerant, very open, and it's a generation that is hot on the lips of every marketer in the country.
Why do you guys want them so badly?
Well, I think what's happened is there's a lot of mystery around them, obviously, and so much has been documented and written both positively and negatively about this group. But I think for marketers, the reason they're such a profound part of the conversation is they represent what the future looks like. And so companies can either succeed or fail as they succeed and fail with millennials. So there's a near-nigh obsession with having conversations with, what technology they're using, what's their values, what's important to them, how to connect with them, how to, you know, frankly, how to develop them as customers for a long period of time.
So I have this whole stack of research on my desk about what you guys do and about millennials. And a lot of this seems to be they want purchases that make them feel good about themselves. They want to be spoken with, not to.
At the end of the day, I think millennials, surprise, surprise, are human beings. And so the things that they want as human beings, to connect with people, to have their voice heard, to be authentic, to laugh, to change the world for better, are very indigenous to this group, as they are to all human beings. What's different is their embrace of technology allows them to, in a much more intense way, access those human emotions, access their voice being heard. The way they view brands, the way they distribute content, the way they sort of raise their voices and want others to hear them is more profound and more intense than previous generations.
So I looked at this ad that you guys did for McDonald's where it plays Debussy's Clair de Lune, and, you know, there are these very simple text references to woman plus shark plus da-da-dum, or you talking to me plus you're talking to me, you're talking to me. And then the end is, you know, all beef patty, lettuce, cheese, special sauce.
Yes.
Etc. And amazingly, the score morphs into that sort of three-note McDonald's piece of music. And I asked my millennial producer about it, and she said she liked the simplicity, the climax, and then this sort of sense that they're not trying to sell me anything specific. They're trying to sell me McDonald's. But I was like, this is a massive company. Of course they're trying to sell you stuff. Well, why does that work?
Well, that particular ad appeared and was customized for the Academy Awards. And I think what made it work was it was contextually appropriate for the Academy Awards. So it wasn't trying to force you to run to the store to buy a burger and fries. It was reminding you of the iconic nature of the Big Mac in the context of other big iconic reference points, other movies. And so I think...
Nostalgia.
Yes, nostalgia for something that's been around for long periods of time, just like all those movies. So I think McDonald's spoke to the audience in the right way, in an authentic way, in a credible way. That is a big part of millennials. It's speak with the right note, with the right subject, at the right time. And I think that is more pronounced for this generation because of 85% ownership of smartphones. They want it when they want it.
Where are you trying to reach them? Is this all about smartphones and social networks?
I don't know. It's not, actually. I think those social networks are obviously an important part of distributing content. But it starts with what do they want to share? So when you get a germ of an idea like a girl, for instance, for Always.
My name is Dakota, and I'm 10 years old.
Show me what it looks like to run like a girl.
It was a video that was created on YouTube.
Throw like a girl.
That took on this whole issue of...
Fight like a girl.
Why is like a girl an insult?
What does it mean to you when I say run like a girl?
It means run fast as you can.
That shouldn't be an insult. And we created a piece of content for 2 minutes that started on YouTube, but it started and galvanized, frankly, a global conversation. And interestingly, what happened with that, it got 60 million views on YouTube, and then it turned into a Super Bowl spot.
Some of your clients, you know, we're talking brands that have been around for a long time, McDonald's, Coke, Samsung. How do you take a vintage brand and sell it to that demographic?
What I would say is we don't treat brands that are mature and have been around a long time any different than we treat a young brand. Because at the end of the day, they're trying to connect with their audiences. So McDonald's will connect very differently than a technology brand like Nintendo or Samsung. So McDonald's, for instance, Pay With Lovin' was the thing that we did in the store during the Super Bowl. And it allowed, when people came in, people actually got a free meal if they did something loving to their parents, to the person with them, if they made a call to someone.
Oh, come on.
Yes. And so it was real, and it encouraged a connection between people. And that's a natural conversation coming from McDonald's.
Isn't there something tremendously ironic about pursuing authenticity in a multi-million dollar advertising campaign that is designed to sell things?
I think in a previous era, the era of the hidden persuaders, that era is dead. Authentic, credible, real connections between brands and people, including millennials, is where marketing and brands are going. And of course...
But the bottom line is about making money, isn't it?
Well, of course, yes. The bottom line is also about doing good for the world, and those two are not mutually exclusive. But certainly, the health of a company is a big part of this. But a health of a company like McDonald's and Coke depends on them having real connections with millennials. If they have a fake connection with them, they won't grow.
Mick McCabe is a chief strategy officer for Leo Burnett USA. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We've moved through time on the show today, from boomers to Gen X to millennials. Each generation has a voice, a history, but this next one is pretty new. Generation Z is just getting its financial footing. We're talking about people in elementary school during the recession. They're still kids for now, but some of them are going off to college and thinking about work, the economy, and their future. We visited John Marshall High School in Los Angeles to talk with four seniors headed to college next year about how their lives and their generation are shaped by money.
Hi, my name is Diego Jimenez. I'm a senior here at John Marshall High School, and next year I'll be attending the University of California, Berkeley.
My name is Emmanuel Reyes. I will be attending UC Santa Barbara in the fall.
Hi, I'm Tia, and I'm a senior at John Marshall High School. I'm going to go to Occidental College in Eagle Rock.
My name's Beja Wolf, and I'm going to Lewis and Clark College next year. I don't think I've really trusted the economy because I've been indoctrinated with this kind of cynical viewpoint of, like, you're not going to get a job, especially because in middle school and early high school, we were going through a recession, and I was very, like, I think my parents were very aware of that. Everyone around me was telling me that, you know, since I'm an artist and I like to write, I pursue more of the humanities path, I wasn't going to make any money as a college grad. And, you know, unless you go into science or math, you're really not going to get a steady paycheck right out of college. But I find that, like, a lot of people I've talked to, they are able to find jobs out of the strangest majors that you wouldn't expect to, like, coalesce with the, what they ended up doing. And so that's given me kind of hope. But before that, I seem to have this, I mean, I don't really think that I'll get a good job out of college. Definitely not. I think that I'm going to have to work a while.
The economy sort of, it's getting better. So I'd like to trust the economy, but we were in a recession. So I'm not quite sure how trustworthy it is right now.
Right now, I'm saving for college, you know, because that's going to be a big thing. I'm getting a lot of financial aid, but there's still a certain pieces that I'm not going to be able to, you know, get covered by financial aid. So I have to save this money up for future books or fees that are going to come up eventually. I work for a catering company. It's nothing big, but it's a little extra that I can, you know, help my family out, pay bills. And it's not going to pay them full, but it's a help. I come from an immigrant family. We're always, like, tight on money and always struggling to make ends meet. So I tend to spend my money wisely, which is kind of hard when you're, like, a teenager because you want to buy, like, all the new shoes, new, you know, things. But I have to, like, save it up.
Well, I've been pretty fortunate growing up, so, you know, there's always been money. But I feel like it holds a certain amount of importance, but it's not always the top priority in my life. So
I approach money, I think, from, like, a frugal perspective, but also definitely from a place where I don't know that much about it yet. I've only once had a job with a paycheck, and it was a stipend. And since then, I tutor. That's basically my main gig right now, is I tutor, and I get money for that. But it's cash, so it's not, I don't have the concept of being part of the monetary system in a way. I just kind of, like, have the idea that I should be careful with my money, and, you know, I should spend it wisely.
I think money is really important. I mean, I spend money on food and clothes and the basic necessities.
I'd say the majority of teenagers kind of spend their money on food.
Spend a lot of money on food, you know, clothes, gas, going places, that kind of thing. But I also save money, like, I'm saving, for a while I put aside $20 a week to save for my senior dues. I'm putting aside money for a road trip I'm taking with my friends, that kind of thing.
So for next year, I've somewhat started saving. My parents are also contributing, but the school's also helping with financial aid as well. So it's not that big of a burden.
I was very fortunate. I got a very generous offer from Berkeley, and my parents were pretty well prepared. My dad started saving, actually, I think the day I was born for this time, you know. So if the financial aid offer stays the same, there shouldn't be a problem, and I'll probably graduate debt-free.
There should be a manual for all these kids who want to figure out how they're going to pay for college, because it's a big mess that we don't really realize when we're thinking of schools we want to go to. I don't think I knew anything about money or how colleges work with money until I filled out the FAFSA and the CSS profile with my dad, and that was confusing. It definitely taught me a lot because I didn't know what, you know, a savings plan, 529, how they worked, what, you know, your income taxes, etc.
It's kind of scary. That's, like, one of my biggest fears, is that me going through college and, you know, investing all this money on my education and coming out without a job. I want to believe that I will find a job, and I hope that's the case, that when I come out, there's going to be a job waiting for me.
I hope there's a job waiting for me. after college, but I guess time will tell depending on how the economy is. And I know that a lot of people now who have college degrees are unemployed. So factoring that there may not be, but I'm hoping so. I'm going to go to college and hope for the best.
I wouldn't necessarily say that I trust the economy so much as I trust myself, you know? But I think that in the past, yeah, people have been pretty skeptical and, like, you know, they're not really sure if a college education is worth investing because it's so hard to get a job nowadays. But I think that that those days are kind of past us, and if you work hard, you know, there's definitely a spot for you.
Last week, we asked you, our listeners, to tell us about the first thing you ever saved up to buy. And the results were amazing. They ranged from school lunch to the Beatles album Rubber Soul. A lot of you wrote in about first bikes. I remember the first thing I saved to buy with my own money was the album Thriller. And your responses got our multi-generational marketplace staff talking, too. We even got a letter in our listener inbox from some dude named Kai. So here's what the marketplacers first saved up for.
Hey, this is Kai Rizdahl. The first thing I ever bought for myself was a 10-speed Peugeot bicycle. It was $110. It was green. I was like 11 or 12 years old, I guess.
My name is Betsy Streisand. First thing I remember really saving for was a pair of bright blue clogs. I didn't even really love the blue, but I wanted clogs so badly.
David Brancaccio from the Marketplace Morning Report here. First thing I ever saved up for, I think it was a big old model rocket. I was totally into that when I was in fifth grade. And I think it was saving up for the Scrambler. This was a model rocket that you built out of balsa wood and white glue that you put an uncooked egg in. The idea was to use the parachute to recover the rocket with the egg intact. Real question was, where did I get the money for this? Maybe babysitting for my siblings, I was paid a little bit. But what I fear is that most of my money for model rockets was slowly, methodically pilfered from my father's tweed jackets.
Hi, it's Dave Shaw. I'm the Washington Bureau Chief for Marketplace. And when I was about 9 or 10, I saved and saved and saved for a Walkman, which was the iPod of its time, which was the iPhone of its time. And it was probably about $80. And so at a $2 allowance per week, plus some birthday money, holiday money, it probably took about 8 or 10 months. And when I finally went with my dad to the Radio Shack to buy it, I decided it was too much money to spend on something like that. And I have no idea what I did with the money. Instead, I wish I had invested it.
My name is Mukta Mohan. I think the first thing I bought was a sparkly sequin-covered goldfish bag. It was a little tiny purse that my friend was selling, and I think she charged me $2 for it, so I bought it directly off her. And then later on, I went and bought a sparkly sequin-covered puppy purse.
My name is Julian Burrell, and the first thing that I ever saved up to buy was a Game Boy Color because I lost my first Game Boy. And my parents decided that even though they didn't even buy me my first one, that I needed to buy the second one, too.
I'm Eliza Mills. The first thing I ever bought with my own money was a scooter. I had to save up double what it cost because my parents wanted me to put half of it in the bank. But it was so worth it once I got it.
My name is Dan Semitovich. I'm the senior producer for Marketplace Weekend. And the very first thing I saved up to buy was the soundtrack to the motion picture Top Gun. And I worked really hard, and I saved up all my allowance money, and I finally had enough to buy the CD. And once I got it, it took my breath away.
Dan, no. Absolutely not. Also, you have hit your quota on Top Gun music. Forever.
Fine. All right. Hit the theme music.
Thank you. Okay, that's our show for this week. Next week, communities. We want to know, what's the most important community you've been a part of? And how did it affect your life? You know where to find us. MarketplaceWeekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, and on Twitter, @MarketplaceWKND. I'm pretty much always tweeting, so come find me. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Sumatovich is our senior producer, and Ravi Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.